field recorder, so she uses it to record sounds as well as interviews. Are we all set up? Brilliant. Okay, just double check there's no one else. And just say, I won't give much of a long introduction. Derek can also give some introduction, I suppose, as he goes through the presentation, but just to say that we will have drinks afterwards. We have got more than one bottle of wine, that's just the red. Fortunately, the fridge is completely stuffed full of alcohol because we have a party at the end tomorrow. So, yeah, welcome to stay for that. And of course, we'll see. We've got up to, I guess, sort of 6 o'clock, quarter to six, if need be. But most people normally don't talk for more than about 45 minutes an hour. Derek, it's entirely
okay.
Up to you. And
no, I'm not going to talk longer than that.
And just thank you very much
likely
for
less.
Joining us today and talking.
Okay, it's a pleasure. Well, thank you for asking me. I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do, but I did decide that I didn't just want to get into a discussion of measurement, and would rather put it in the framework of some wider issues. Okay. I want to start out with talking a bit about what I think are a couple of fairly striking broad correlations between the results produced by the REF and the results produced by other forms of ranking of universities. And the main point is that at the level of the institution, there's actually been a rather good correlation between performance in the RAE, set of REEs, and in the REF, and positions in the major global university rankings, right? Despite major differences in methodology. None of the major university rankings do any kind of peer review. the valuation of outputs does account for more than about 40% of their overall rankings. But such measurements as they do of that is entirely metrics-based. Right. The other major component in both the QR and the Times Higher rankings is a reputational survey. Right. So despite very different methodologies, you actually come up with some quite striking correlations. I stress at the level of the university, not necessarily at the level of the individual discipline, and certainly not at the level of the individual, because there's no attempt to measure the value of individuals' outputs. But it could be argued that the institution is the appropriate level of analysis from the point of view of this comparison, because universities are not obliged to spend QR money on the basis of how their different units rank in the REE, and frequently they don't. Okay. Now, I've just given you the broad correlations here. There are 7 UK universities that make it into the top 50 in the Times Higher rankings. 6 of those are in the REF top 10, and the other one, which is actually Edinburgh, is number 11. 11 UK universities in the top 100, only one of those is outside the REF top 20. 22 in the top 150, only 2 of which are outside of the REF top 30, and so on. Right? Now, there are definite outliers, but they are outliers. Now, the second fairly striking correlation of the successive REs, REFs, that I'd like to draw attention to at the outset is with the performance of research elite universities, by which I mean roughly the Russell Group. We can argue about the ones near the bottom of that, whether they are or should be part of an elite, but for these purposes, take the Russell Group and the former 1994 Group, which disintegrated a couple of years ago, with several of its members moving into the Russell Group. I think LSE itself was actually part of the Russell Group, the 94 Group at one point. Now, the Russell Group and the 1994 Group, between them, receiving almost 85% of QR funding on the eve of REF 2014. They had actually, the share of the Russell Group following RE2008 actually fell to 65%. And they put a fair amount of pressure on the government. The government caved in on it. Government, in turn, put pressure on Hefke, and Hefke changed the funding formula in such a way that by 2010 to 11, their share had actually risen by 10 percentage points. Right now, the REF 2014, that has fallen by 1 percentage point. Okay. So not only do we have fairly striking correlations between, at the growth institutional level, between REF performance and performance in Times Higher and other global university rankings, we also find that the major beneficiaries from the RE and REF themselves have been remarkably consistent from RE to REE, and it's hence eminently predictable who's going to do very well out of it. Now, at that point, the obvious question that occurs, at least to me, isn't the whole ritual an enormous waste of time and money and a very elaborate way of confirming what we all already know? Okay. Now, I'd say that, put in more formal terms, there's at least a prima facie case for looking at less costly alternatives for allocating QR research funding. And I'd add, at this point, that case becomes the more compelling the more the QR pot actually shrinks. And given the latest projected cuts to government, it may well shrink by as much as a third. Okay. Right, so let's talk a bit about the costs of the REF. This is quite a nice quote from Peter Scott. Although few people are prepared to admit it, the REF has become a monster, a minotaur that must be appeased by bloody sacrifices. Nice little article in The Guardian. Okay, so start off with just an indication of how the REF regime has grown since it was first instituted, which was back in 1986, just before same year as I left the UK for Canada and didn't come back for another 20 years. So all of this I've learned about, I've not experienced, so I came back here. But what was required in 1986 was a 4-page general description of the strengths from each department, 4 pages, and 5 outputs from each department, upon which the department was content to be judged. And they didn't have any special panels. These were judged by the UGC, which was the University Grants Committee as a predecessor to Hefke. They were judged by their existing subject panels. So it was a very rough and ready thing, but actually it came up with results that are not much different than what we got now. Now, that lasted only 3 years. 1989, by that point, they had actually abolished the UGC. Universities themselves took the view that the just 4 pages from each department and only 5 outputs didn't really allow them to showcase their strengths. So they were actually asking for much more. So what happened at that point, you could say it was the first real REE. For the first time, you got these specially convened panels, right? 70 of them at that point in time, to evaluate 152 UOAs. And each staff member was at that point required to submit 2 outputs. Okay. So it's a lot more than previously, but only half of what we've now got. 1996, that went up to 4 outputs. Things were getting at that point much more bureaucratic and much more legalistic, and a couple of institutions had actually sued Hefke because they felt that they'd been unfairly treated in the previous REF. They didn't win the case, but the judge basically said to Hefke, you've got to get your act together. You can't just say that these are experts in the field and therefore their judgment can be trusted. You need to have much more precise specification of panel criteria and stuff like that. So for the first time then in 1996, panel assessment criteria and working methods were published in advance. And things got steadily more complex. The other thing that I think is very important in terms of the actual costs, and particularly the growth of the amount of work required at university level in the big trajectory from 86 until REF 2014, was the defunding of two-star outputs in 2010. Prior to that, you got a certain amount of money for two-star, rather more for three-star, more still for four-star. In 2010, Hefke, again under pressure from the government to be more selective and concentrate resources, defunded two-star outputs. Now, at that point, a lot of universities took the view that, fairly rationally, there is absolutely no point in now putting people in who are going to score below a GPA of 3, right? But then we have to have some mechanism to ensure that we can weed those people out. That then led to more or less elaborate internal refs, with bringing in, you know, external so-called experts, critical friends, whatever terminology you care to use, and a huge internal bureaucracy to administer all this. And again, concerns at least some universities that they should be able to defend themselves against any possible litigation. If they cannot be seen to be, or at least make the claim that they've actually been fair. Okay. The final thing that also increased the amount of work that needed to be done was REF 2014's introduction of impact as an element of the assessment, which it hadn't been in any previous REF. And it's a very important element because it counts at 20%. Right? So these were all factors driving up the cost, driving up the time, and so on. So take it by numbers briefly. 36 sub-panels, which have between 10 and 30 members. These are the panels that actually read the stuff and give the evaluations, right? Of whom there's nearly 900 academic members. That's people who are judged competent to assess output. Right. There are other members who were research users, who in general didn't judge outputs. These 900 or so people evaluated 1,900 or so submissions from individual UOAs, containing 190,000 individual research outputs, and nearly 7,000 impact case studies, from over 50,000 staff, all in less than a year. Okay. And I think in any discussion of the REF, these bread and butter issues are quite important. And I'll come back to some of them later. Now, okay, let's break down the direct costs and the indirect costs of the REF, which is something that's not that easy to do. Hefke itself calculated the total costs of RE 2008 as nearly 60 million, of which 47 million was within universities, 12 million was Hefke's own costs of administering it, right? So 60 million. For REF 2014, they've revised it upwards and they said it cost them 14.4 million, Hefke itself, right? Now, we would assume there'd be a similar kind of inflation in the actual costs to universities, right? But we also have some rather more precise estimates. RAND Europe did a study, I think actually for Hefke, estimated the cost to universities of preparing impact submissions alone, right? So that's just that one element of the REF, at 55 million, I think plus minus 5 million. One anonymous university research head, who was close to those times higher, said an honest assessment would be nearer 200 million. Another estimate, Robert Bowman, at Queen's University Belfast, estimates the real cost was more than a billion, right? Now, the basis on which that is calculated is simply that he did full economic costing for the salaries of the people that were sitting on all these committees and everything else, exactly the same way as you and I would do if we apply for a research grant. And if you do that calculation, which none of these others, RANS or FQ or anybody else, this calculation, if you do that calculation, then it is going to come up much, much higher. Possibly not a billion, but much higher. Leaving aside the direct financial costs, I think the thing that really needs to be emphasised is the opportunity costs. The vast amounts of time that are spent by both the people sitting on the REF panels and those involved in REF preparation at university level to get the thing done at all. Right? This is all, of course, time that could be spent on actually researching or teaching or other things that once upon a time we used to do in universities. For the panellists, I would argue that if they do the job remotely properly, it is basically a full year's work. They can have very little time to do anything else, right? So let's try and cost that for a minute. Panellists tend to be generally fairly eminent people, right? So I will assume that each member of each panel earns the average professorial salary, which in the UK, the latest figure is 76,000. If you multiply the number of people that sit on the REF panels by that figure, you get 68 million, right? That's just the cost, opportunity cost of the panels, right? Now then let's take it down to university level. And I took here my own department, and like many other departments around the country, we have a full-time research director in the department, and during the 2 years immediately leading up to the REF, she was given sub-teaching release, etc., etc., in order to have time to work on the REF. In terms of our departmental workload model, that was one-third of time, right, during those 2 years. So again, I'll say one-third of somebody's time over a two-year period, taking the average full professor salary, we now find that the net opportunity costs of department research directors alone is close on another 100 million. Right? Now, this is not to account to allow the whole army of impact champions, associate deans, research, members ad hoc of central REF steering committee who've got experience of sitting on RAE panels, and so on and so on, who all could be doing other things if they weren't doing the REF. So we're talking about a lot of money. And I won't mention simply the time, etc. Now again, we could talk about possible costs for other academic values. This is probably old ground for most of you, so I'll just go through it more briefly. It's quite clear that the REF increasingly drives university priorities, particularly in hiring, and particularly in the 2 or 3 years before the REF. Arguably distorting wider discussions about research teaching balance, research strategy generally, etc. Again, it's arguable, but I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that interdisciplinary or other research which is seen as risky at university level gets marginalised. Now, this is not necessarily because the REF panels themselves are hostile to such work. Often, actually, I think they're not. It is because universities second guess how the REF panels are going to behave, and anything that looks remotely risky gets pushed out. And people act accordingly because they want to be included in the REF. I know it's probably the only person in the country that appealed against being included in the REF. But then I was old and close to retirement, so I can afford to. Third thing, I think, a definite cost is that the introduction of impact as a dimension of the assessment. Now, I'm not opposed to that notion that we should be concerned about what impact academic research has. What I am suggesting is a particular formula that was used in the REF had the rather perverse consequence that if universities were to decide where to put their efforts, a highly ranked impact study, right, that possibly was based on not particularly outstanding research, it only had to be 2-star, would be a much better bet than putting in any one individual, right? Simply because of the numbers. So I think that created incentives for universities to prioritise research that was likely to have short-term impact. Okay. Even when the quality of that research is not particularly high and wouldn't actually itself bring in QR funding. Okay. The other more obvious point that I may say but more about later if we have time is that pressures to be selective in determining which staff were submitted to the REF fairly clearly undermine morale and jeopardise collegiality, and they've led to a lot of bad blood in a lot of universities. And you take someone else, I won't talk about my own university, Cardiff, which is now apparently the 5th best university in the country or something like that. Well, they achieved that at the on the basis of putting in, I think, only 60% of their staff, or possibly as only 50% of their staff, right? That will have led to a lot of insecurity on the part of people who didn't get in, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, it's been covered well enough in Times Higher and elsewhere. I don't think I need to say that much more about that. Yeah, this just elaborates a bit on what I just said. But the main thing I point to here is the last element, which is that threats of compulsory redundancy, transfer to teaching-only contracts and other disciplinary action was reported at numerous universities for academic staff not entered in the RAF. Now, I don't think that the key issue here is whether these threats have been carried out, as the effect that they will have as a disciplinary tool over an academic workforce that doesn't have tenure. I gather LSE you are actually, you have something a bit more like tenure.
We have a tenure system, but it's not allowed to be called or marketed as tenure because officially it isn't, because the
right. But you actually have stronger protection than most academics,
no? No, I think we just have a higher bar to
go across. Okay. I mean, certainly a permanent position in a university in this country is not the same as a tenured position in the United States or Canada. And that means that if, you know, line managers, which again is something that don't actually exist in North America, are muttering that, you know, unless you get in the REF, you're going to be transferred to a teaching only contract or whatever, you are going to adapt your behaviour accordingly. Okay, and that's what I mean about tool of discipline. Okay, so I've tried to make the point that it costs an awful lot, both financially, opportunity costs, and costs to other academic values. So the question at this point I want to ask is it worth it? Well, I would say that the costs are so high that they can only be justified if they deliver benefits that could not be achieved by other means that are less costly. And that's the standpoint from which we should be evaluating. Now, at that point, let's break the question down into two more questions. Firstly, in its own terms, is the REF at least reliable as a means of evaluating research quality? Does it do what it says on the tin? And secondly, even if it is, could similar findings be generated using alternative methods of research evaluation? And most obviously, at that point, we start talking about metrics, right? And I underline here that the REF is not inevitable. These costs are not incurred by many other university systems, including the USA, which is simply not centralised enough to do it, even if they wanted to, right? Where it just so happens that 7 of the top 10 and 15 of the top 20 universities in the world on the THE rankings are actually located. They match perfectly well without a REF, okay? Okay, the core of my argument, which I developed in the book that I'm shamelessly publicising here, is I kind of challenge the claim from which the REF derives its entire authority as a mechanism for funding allocation and its legitimacy as a process of evaluation, which is the claim that it is a process of expert peer review. It's on that basis that so far Hefke persuaded the government to back down on plans to introduce metrics, which originally the Labour government wanted to do it. I believe that case is false. I do not believe that what the REF does is in any meaningful sense of the word expert peer review. And it's that I want to go on and talk about now. Okay, what I've done in the book is to compare the procedures by which the REF evaluates outputs with peer reviewing procedures used in other contexts in the UK and internationally, which is primarily journal and book publication processes of review, processes of peer review that are used in research grant competitions by both government funding agencies and private foundations, and the kinds of procedures that are used in tenure and promotion cases, right? And I would argue that judged against any of these, including the way these things are done in the UK, the REF is a downright embarrassment. Now, let me try and say why. Firstly, all review in the REF is done in-house by members of REF subpanels. Previous REEs, they allowed the use of external specialist reviewers if or when a panel felt that it was unable to assess, evaluate a particular output. That was stopped after RE 2008. So all the review is done in-house by these panels of 10 to 30 people for each discipline. On some panels, including the history panel, which is my own discipline, the volume of work is such that just one assessor may read an output. Right? Other panels, it's two. Okay? But if any of us submit an article to an academic journal, we would expect, as a matter of course, that there would be at least one review. Right? I actually read something in the Times Higher this week, a recent study, and I know this is the case from my own experience of being a journal editor, that a good third of cases where articles are sent out for review, you send them to two people and you actually get diametrically opposed evaluations. Typically, as a journal editor, I would then do two things. One is I'd commission at least one more review to break the tie. And the other is I would talk to the author, right, about what particular points are being raised. But no, our REF system only has, in some cases, just one assessor. Third point is that Hefke had very strict prohibitions on using any kind of bibliometric data or perceived standing of journals and publishers. Part of the reason they did that was because of the academic community's general hostility to metrics. But the effect of that meant that, for example, whether a book was published by, I don't know, Harvard or Chicago University Press, or whether it was simply put up on your local university repository, would count exactly the same. It didn't mean anything if you got into a top journal in any field, notwithstanding the fact that it might be extremely difficult to do so, because the panels were not allowed to take these things into account. Now, I would argue that might be acceptable if you could be sure that the panel itself had a sufficient range of expertise, but it doesn't. So it just reinforces this dependence on subjective judgments. Two more points here I think are relevant. One is that almost all of the sub-panelists who do the grading are drawn from British universities alone. Now, I find something slightly perverse, if not extraordinarily arrogant, and very British, about the assumption that Brits can unilaterally determine the international standing of all the outputs that they're assessing across all the disciplines they're doing it. And the scale is in terms of international standing. It's internationally, it's world-leading, internationally excellent, internationally recognized. But those judgments are made almost entirely by people working in British universities. Finally, the number of disciplinary panels was reduced from 67 in 2008 to 36 in 2014. basically to make it less cumbersome, to save time and money. But that left a lot of people concerned that this would narrow the range of expertise in their particular area, particularly where panels were merged. Okay. Now, those are particular series of inadequacies. I want to make two specific claims. One is that they lack the expertise to do their job. I would claim that they rarely contain sufficient breadth and depth of expertise to evaluate the full range of outputs that fall under their remit. While panel members may be professionally eminent, that doesn't mean that they necessarily have specialist knowledge in the particular fields in which the work that they're evaluating has been published, right? And I'd argue it's exactly specialist knowledge that you need to distinguish between internationally recognised, internationally excellent, and world-leading. Without such expertise, how can they possibly judge the originality, the significance, in particular, of a contribution, since, almost by definition, these are relative to a particular field? Now, take a very specific example, my own discipline, history. No members of the panel who specialise in the history of China, Latin America, the Middle East, about two-thirds of Europe, including Spain, Turkey and Austria-Hungary, which were all at one point great powers. If there's nobody on those panels who knows the languages, who knows the archives, who knows the secondary literatures, which will often not be in English, on what possible basis can they make a judgment as to how internationally excellent the work is, especially if they're not allowed to take into account such things as how often it's cited, how other people have reviewed it, and who's published it, and where. In my own case, for example, I work on Czech history. My work is almost entirely dependent on Czech language sources. There's nobody up there, history panel, has any expertise in that field, right? So that's the first ground in which I say it is simply not peer review in any sense in which academics normally understand that term. Secondly, and I think equally critically, REF panelists actually lack the time to do their job. Less than 1,000 REF assessors, it's closer to 900, grade nearly 200,000 outputs in less than a year. Now this is about the same number of people as the American National Endowment for the Humanities uses to evaluate 5,700 applications for 40 programs. I think it's a relevant comparison if we're claiming it's an international excellence and world-leading research. I've given a couple of other quotes here which you can read for yourself, but basically the point is they do not have time to do the job, and the more honest of them will actually admit that. Even Hefkes itself has acknowledged panellist workload as a problem, though they haven't said that it in any way compromises the trust we might place in their judgments. The report they produced after the REF is recommending that any future REF consider sampling outputs rather than reading all of them, despite the fact that they expect REF panels unanimously to oppose this. Now, that's an indication of how seriously Hefke takes the problem. Okay, let's move on. Are metrics a viable alternative? Well, one of the leading advocates of metrics in this country, Dorothy Bishop, who's a professor of psychology at Oxford, puts the case, I think, fairly succinctly. It's transparent and objective. It would not require departments to decide who they do and don't enter for the assessment, and most importantly, it wins down on, hands down on, cost effectiveness. That's the argument that she puts forward. I'll skip over this beyond simply. Gordon Brown unilaterally announced back in 2006 that they were going to replace the RE with metrics after RE 2008, asked Hefke to consult on it. Hefke did so, and the entire British academic establishment, everybody, said, no, 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 we do not want metrics. The academic community, or at least its accredited representatives, were overwhelmingly opposed to it. And I think it's fair to say that that remains the case. Okay. Among the most common arguments against bibliometrics, and bibliometrics, of course, is only a subset of other metrics that one might use, right? But it's bibliometrics that have been always talked about as an alternative way of evaluating outputs, which is 65% of the current evaluation. Main arguments used against it are that one commonly used metric, which is journal impact factors, can't be used as proxy for quality of individual articles because we all know high-impact journals may publish individual articles which are not of good quality. A second argument is that using citations as evidence of quality ignores self-citation, negative citation, and a disproportionate citation of things not because they are original and important research articles, but because they simply are very competent surveys of the field. Humanities is very concerned that the major citation indexes ignore monographs, which are actually more important in a discipline like mine than articles as a rule. And related to that, volumes of both outputs and citations differ across disciplines. So I think my H index is about 18, which is fine for a historian, but it would be pretty awful if I were an economist or a psychologist or a physicist. I would argue that most of these objections could be accommodated by designing better metrics. There's no reason whatsoever why we should use GIFs. You can exclude self-citation. And you can use things like Google Scholar or Publish and Perish, which do include monographs. We could certainly standardize for disciplines or fields, right? And if we put our mind to it, we could explore a whole range of possible alt metrics of one kind or another. But you're not going to do that as long as we simply assume, and most of the debates about the use of metric do assume, that peer review is the gold standard against which we must measure, right? Which is why I think it's so important to realise that what's done in the ref is not peer review. Okay. Now, I would argue that whatever the difficulties of metrics, ignoring whether an output has gone through any prior process of peer review, by experts in the field, where it's been published, how it's been received, and how often it's been cited, in favour of the subjective opinion of evaluators who may have no specialised knowledge in the field, is not really a defensible alternative. Secondly, and this comes back to where I started, whatever the limitations of valid measure of the quality of individual outputs, metrics as used in global ranking have proved fairly reliable as a predictor of ref performance at the level of the institution. Right. And thirdly, and this is incontestable, that the adoption of metrics would deliver comparable outcomes to the ref, broadly comparable, for a fraction of the financial and other costs associated with it. Now, if that's all the case, if that's all true, one has to ask, why is the UK academic establishment so insistent on maintaining expert review, peer review, under these circumstances, especially when it's not actually expert peer review? And I would suggest that the answer is that they have a very strong stake in the REF panel process itself, quite independent of its merits as a means of research evaluation. Or to put it in Latin, cui bono. Who actually does benefit from the ref? Let's pass over this, actually. I want to give you five reasons why Britain's established academic elites like the REF. The first one is that it is an excellent tool of internal discipline for university managers, because it makes all research activity financially accountable. happened visible. When I first came back from North America and started working in Lancaster, I was appalled one day to hear a senior administrator ask the question, can we afford to have staff members doing research that isn't funded? Now, what I took that to mean is, can we afford to have people doing research that doesn't bring in external research grants from SRC, Lever Hume, stuff like that? But it wasn't. What it meant was, can we afford to have people who either are not bringing that in, right, external funds in that sense, or are not getting QR money? Okay. Because what QR money actually does is it basically issues a point of saying, well, if it doesn't get QR money, it's not research. Okay, it's not time that's actually paid to do the research. So it's a very strong, hugely strong tool of discipline at the institutional level. Less obviously, but I think equally importantly, the RAF machinery is tailor-made for the reproduction of disciplinary hierarchies and networks. And if you look in detail at how panel members are selected, how panels are composed, and so on, you see, for example, that the the position of chairs of REF panels is one that is publicly advertised. People compete for it. But thereafter, it's almost all nomination. Right? But even at the level of the panel chairs, you cannot be considered for chairing a panel unless you have an endorsement from the relevant professional association or associations. Right. So if you don't have an endorsement from the British Sociological Association, you can forget about being considered to become chair of the sociology panel and so on. Right? Which means that these bodies can exercise a fairly considerable gatekeeping function at the outset. Now, once the panel sub-panel heads are actually appointed, they then have the major say on the appointment of panel members. And these positions are not allocated through any process of competition. It works through a process of nomination. Right? And Hefke will then decide on the composition of the panels on the advice of the panel chairs. Similarly, whether you then get to talk about using supplementary assessors, it is the members of the panel who decide who they should be. Right. It's all very cozy. And if you look at, I haven't done this for every discipline, but I've certainly done it for my own. And we have a 25-member panel of whom I think only two members were not Russell Group, 1994 Group. In other words, exactly the same people who at the end of the day benefit from this process. So I would argue it's a process through which hierarchies, both within disciplines and across universities, are replicated, and they are legitimated in the same process. The fact that it's a national masquerades as a national exercise carried out under the watchful eye of a public body means that REF scores have far more legitimacy than they would done if it was just done by your own university management. Right? It was that, for example, that allowed Birmingham University to close down with, at the end of the day, relatively little effective protest. The Institute for Contemporary Cultural Studies, which was world-renowned. And there was an academic outcry, but they said, sorry, they were underperforming based on the ranking that they got in the REF. Right. Now, the major beneficiaries of this, and I think this is absolutely incontestable, have been the Russell Group and other traditional elite pre-1994 universities. And this has happened from REF, RAE to RAE, to REF. So I would argue that the REF both legitimates this dominance and is a key vehicle for financially and otherwise maintaining it. Which is why I say we actually need a sociology of the REF. Do I have time briefly to say something about alternatives? Okay. I didn't come in here in order to try and argue for metrics for the sake of it as against the existing peer review. I want to suggest that what we should do is adopt some general principles for what I call restoring sanity, and then work out how those might best be implemented. Well, the first one I would suggest is that we return to what the RE was originally intended to be, which was simply a mechanism for allocating QR money between universities, not something that vice chancellors could use to discipline their staff, not something that groups within disciplines could use to impose their particular vision of what the discipline should be, right? Purely and simply a reasonably fair way of allocating resources. The second thing is that we should confine information that's gathered for the assessment to the minimum necessary and sufficient to enable reasonably informed, objective and fair judgments of institutional quality. I stress that, to be made. Now, in order to do that, since, among other things, we found that at times higher education can come up with similar judgments without seeing a single output by anybody, do we really need to have four outputs from every faculty member in the land in every discipline? Because if we had fewer outputs, you know, it might actually allow for more rigorous peer review, which did involve genuine subject matter experts. Now, thirdly, on very sort of similar grounds, yes, of course, there are problems with metrics. There are problems with any form of measuring any measurement. But we could reasonably ask in a sort of non-prejudiced way to say, are there any discipline-appropriate metrics that we might use to at least inform the value of the judgments that are made by experts, including alt metrics, right? I mean, for example, I would like to see citations taken into account, if only because if something is a heavily cited article or book, and we've got an assessor say, well, I'm sorry, I think that's only worth a two, right? There's at least a basis. So, hang on a minute, there is some evidence that the wider academic community actually takes a different view from you. So can you please justify that view and tell us why, despite the fact that it's widely cited, or despite the fact that it's published in a top journal, you think it only ranks one or two, right? In other words, it's a control. And finally, if we must have an REF, can we try and make it as cost-effective as possible and try and minimise opportunities for gaming, right? Now, again, I mean... It has been argued that a lot of people said, well, why don't we simply force every university to enter in the REF, everybody who's on a contract that involves doing any research, right? It seems a perfect solution, except that what it's most likely to lead to then is a whole bunch of people immediately being put on teaching-only contracts, right? So there would have to be a lot of thought put into how you avoid these kinds of shenanigans. But at least recognise that there's a problem. I'd also want to put in a slightly wider context and raise sort of two final issues. The first one is the dual support system. As things currently stand, government funding for research goes through two channels. It goes through research councils and it goes through QR, right? Money that goes through the research councils goes for specific projects of one kind or another. QR is supposed to support a general research infrastructure, right? Some people have argued that in order to avoid the enormous costs of the REF, we should just channel everything through the research councils, right? And let people bid for it, and then whatever overhead costs they got, they get from that will support university infrastructures, which is actually more like you have in the United States, right? But under very different conditions. I think that that's highly problematic, and I think if you did it without making certain other changes, then all that would happen is that the same dominance that the Russell Group and so on have through the current REF system, they simply replicate it. But I think you could consider whether if you had a merged budget and you did just go through the research councils, if you put a specific mandate on those councils, right? For example, to use the enhancements of the budget to support individual scholarship, wherever that scholarship may be found, rather than at the moment focusing everything on team research. And you gave them a mandate to support a certain proportion of the budget must be for emerging excellence rather than established schools. Something might be possible down that route. I don't know. The second thing that I would suggest is that what essentially I've argued is that neither REF-style peer review nor metrics are capable of delivering valid judgments of the quality of research outputs. If that's the case, it really seems a bit stupid to give the evaluation of research outputs 65% of the weighting of the total REF score, right? We're giving 65% of the weighting on something that it would appear that we can't measure and that may be inherently unmeasurable, which is the quality of research outputs, right? And perhaps we should instead ask ourselves which features of the research environment that are measurable do correlate with or are most conducive to producing a vibrant research economy. I mean, there are a whole series of potential things that you might put in that basket from, again, varying according to discipline, but from the strength of the library or laboratory resources that an institution offers, the research grant income that it's capable of getting independently, how involved the faculty in going to conferences, in mounting conferences, in journal editing, series editing, how involved are they in professional associations, how many PhD students do you have, what is their completion rate, even what is their employment rate. All of these, I would say, are good indicators of research vitality. Most of them are easier to measure than the quality of research outputs, yet these only count for 15%, whereas the quality issue counts for 65%. And has all these enormous costs that I've tried to talk about today. So that's about it.